Hello and welcome to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
That exciting introduction. It's good to be back with
It
everyone.
was an exciting
Yeah,
one.
wasn't it just vibrant?
It was so different than we normally do.
I know. It's like, we don't have a really great technology for stuff, but here we are, continue to do this. I think this is our, I don't know, something like our 225th episode, just saying.
It's a lot.
So that's pretty good. And we
I
have
was just
some,
kidding about the intro, by the way.
well, I mean, we could try to get cute and use Daffy Duck voices, but I'm not sure that would work.
No.
And I'm not even really capable of doing that. Nevertheless, I'm bummed. I didn't go out really shooting much this week, so I've been doing other things.
I got some in.
That's good. Yeah, that's
Just lightweight stuff, but that's for me, it's a therapeutic thing to do, whether or not I get great images. It's just nice to get out, do some mess around. Usually I'll learn something in the process.
true, like configuring settings or something or
Oh,
whatever.
whatever.
But
Usually it's more a matter of, well, that didn't work
yeah, and that's how
in
you
terms of
learn.
a composition.
That's a good thing. One and a couple, we have a couple of announcements. First one is that we have a late scratch from our Redwood workshop. So if you want to go, we can get you in, but you need to contact us or go out to our event page right away to sign up. We'll keep the space open for another week or two, but because we have to start coordinating with our attendees, there comes a point where it gets too late to sign up for something. So if photographing the Redwoods and the coast of California and Oregon are appealing to you, this is for our trip in mid-May. Drop us a note or go out to our website so you can see the link to register for that.
And this is a great area
Oh, it
that
is.
we're going to. It's one of my favorites.
I'm getting ready to go to Florida in a couple of weeks to do my bird workshop down there. If someone really wanted to go, I could probably accommodate them, but it's getting to be pretty tight on that one too. And that one's oriented towards people with either Nikon or OM System/Olympus cameras, because that's what I know the best.
And I'm guessing that's so that you can help them, especially if they're a relatively new owner of one of those brands of cameras, just get those final tweaks done to get slightly better
Right.
bird photos, plus come away with some great shots too.
It's two things, right? It's the settings for the bird photography itself, but it's also the configuration and customization of settings that are more camera specific. And it's getting to the point where it's very, very narrow. Like the way you configure a camera these days is so personalized. You know, there's functions you want to be able to access, but I can't tell you which button to map it to.
Yeah.
And that's
And
hard.
the other conundrum with all this stuff is introducing this technology to make it easier to get good focus also makes it more complicated to operate the camera, at
Yeah.
least in terms of getting it configured
Right. To
for a
know how things
situation.
to know how things
Yeah.
behave. So these workshops
Just funny.
Are an opportunity for people to go out to the same several places a couple of times and really try different settings and have the opportunity to work those settings and get used to them. Because I think if I just handed you a settings file and said, here's my buttons, you wouldn't know what to do with it. But if you could map those out, get to know what they do, practice it, and then maybe make some tweaks on your own to tailor it to the way you like to shoot or which buttons you like to access, would be very good experience. And you can't do that in an afternoon. You need a few days to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then I released a product yesterday or the other day, earlier this week, 47 or something like 47 Lightroom presets plus 37 profiles. We've talked about creative profiles, which are designed to mimic the look of traditional black and white and color films. So 27 different films. So you've got your Kodaks, your Fujis, your Provias. We talked about using some of these similar types of settings on our Cuba photos where they just deliver a kind of look. And, you know, I don't always want to make my photos look like film, and neither do you. That's not the goal. The goal
No.
isn't to make it match film. But if you say, you know, I kind of like this, you know, punched up look a little bit. Let me start here as a starting point and maybe add in some effects. And if you apply similar processing across a range of images, then they tend to work in a gallery. I think we've both seen this. Like, I wouldn't just throw the one-off vintage picture into a gallery.
It'll look weird.
Yeah, it just seems out of place. But if you do a series of those, or the entire gallery is all processed a certain way, and this started happening when we were out in our road trip last summer, processing things like, you know, vintage film, where this was going on, and that's where I started noticing it. So I took the last couple of months and actually built presets. So if that's something that you're interested in, check out my website, and you can download them from there, luminescentphoto.com. And that's all the shameless self-promotion we have for this episode.
I think that's plenty of it.
But there's two lenses for Nikon that just came out this week, so we thought we would talk a little bit about those.
Yep. And then after that, there's a question that you got regarding ergonomics and how to handle a situation where you're working on a computer editing images for a long period of time.
I think it's a great question, because it does happen.
I
So
think it,
let's.
and there are multiple facets there that I think are worth talking about. So we'll talk about those.
Yeah, cool. Well, so earlier this week, we got, I don't know if it was out of the blue, I haven't been paying attention to the rumor sites, but the Nikon announced a 28 to 400 millimeter lens. It's f4 to f8. So we're talking crazy zoom range, get you out to 400. And also that it sort of goes along with that trend we've been talking about recently with manufacturers being willing to sacrifice aperture for smaller and lighter designs, especially in mirrorless cameras that can support focusing. So
And sometimes it's even whether or not a lens exists. I mean, a 28 to 400 is a pretty wide range.
right. And honestly, if that had been in a 5.6 option, it would have been an absolute beast, right? I
It'd
mean,
be a boat anchor. Yeah.
there's no way you'd want to carry that around. Now, when I saw this announcement, I wonder what your take is, but I was actually kind of pleasantly happy with it, because it offers a way for the people more on the consumer level, or the, you know, the beginner or lower budget, certainly, to get something that gets them out to 400 without spending multiple thousands of dollars. And that's a good thing.
It's something that can enable them to get shots that look distinctly different than what they would get with a cell phone. And that's something that makes, quote, real cameras a little bit more attractive. So I think it's a useful thing. And I could see some people just starting out with a lens like that and many just sticking with it.
So yeah, because it covers a tremendous range. You've got everything from your, you know, street photography focal length to, you know, birds, or at least larger birds, which a lot of people like to shoot. And a lot of people, when they're buying a camera, there is this desire to say, you know what, I've only got enough money for one lens, so what's it going to be? And here's a lens that would cover just crazy amount of range.
Well, think about it this way. Certainly the shorter end of it would handle all sorts of types of photography. I mean, just vast amounts. I'm thinking like the 28 to 105-ish range, the very least. I mean, that's a core range for most people. But also, this is something that you could take to the zoo with you. This is something that you could take to Yellowstone National Park and photograph bison and things like that. You could do quite a bit with it.
Well, I mean, we talked a little bit offline before this, but my very first autofocus lens, right, when I bought an autofocus film SLR, was a Tamron 28 to 300, you know, f3.5 to 5.6, or whatever the heck it was. And it was a bit of a beast, but that's where I was budget-wise. And I thought, okay, I've got the ability to get out to 300 and I took some fun pictures. I would go to the SeaWorld or I'd go to wherever, and you want that extra reach. And having that on your camera and not having to change lenses is pretty good. So 400, that's pretty nice. I would have really liked this lens back when I was in college or grad school and couldn't afford anything, because it would have been an option. It would have been a way for me to get to 400.
And the
Never shooting
SeaWorld
film.
example is a great example, actually, of where that kind of lens would just be fantastic. Not having to change stuff, not having to haul a whole bunch of lenses. You could have just that one lens there and do an awful lot.
Right. And so, what are the downsides of something like this? Well, it's not going to be the best performer optically across the board. Although we did look at the MTF charts, and it does look like this lens would perform far better than the old 28 to 300 F mount, especially at the wide end. And it
That
looks
doesn't
like it
mean
might.
it's going to be a perfect lens.
No, no, no,
It
no.
looks like it's going to get a little bit soft toward the edges and may not have the best
All of those
focus,
things.
but it'll probably be fine.
Yeah, all of those things. But we're talking about an all-in-one lens design too. So, I mean, people can question this all the time, but we're talking about a 14x zoom. Goes to, that's more than 11, Rick.
It
So
is.
let's just talk briefly. So and by the way, the list price on it is just under it's just under $1,300 US. It's not out yet. It's available for pre-order at all the usual places. And it weighs just over a pound and a half. So not a beast, but not a lightweight. It weighs 1.6 pounds, and the old Nikon 28 to 300 F mount weighed 1.75 pounds. And that was a chunk to carry around. So let's
I
look
have
at
to
the,
think in terms of grams
yeah.
for whatever reason. 725 grams. So that's
So
not bad.
it's not a lightweight, but it's not painful.
Right.
You have to be willing to say, okay, so let's ask yourself, if you buy a lens like this, it's probably because it's going to be on your camera most of the time. If you're looking to just have something that's a 400, you might be better looking elsewhere, but this gets you that. And having a dedicated telephoto, so you could, if you don't like walking around with a lot of weight around your neck, this is where we start to get into that question of, does the weight of your kit start to impact your psychological well-being to the point that you're not shooting as much, right? I think you could be okay with this one. It's not quite as light as the 24 to 200, which we've both used.
Right.
And it's a little bit, I want to say it was a, it's similar to the, isn't it similar to the 28 to, or the 24 to 120? It's a little heavier than 24 to 120 F4 in Z mount, which,
I know it's longer
yeah, it's,
as
well,
well,
it's about, it's a
even
little
in
bit
the
lighter.
collapsed
It's sorry,
position.
it's a little bit heavier. It's 725 versus 630 grams. So it's 100 grams more, but that's not crazy. But there's times if you're doing a lot of walking and that's around your neck. Now, if it's the only thing you're bringing, maybe that's worth it because you're not changing lenses. You put it in your bag when you're not shooting it, and it's all good, right?
Yeah, and that would be the thing that would help me using a lens like this, because I don't really like walking around with a longer lens on the camera without a bag. It just flops all around, bangs into things. Inevitably, it zooms out to the longest position, and then it's
Right.
really long. It probably has a lock on it. I haven't checked that, but then you forget to use the lock.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It does have a lock. I just looked at the pictures.
Good.
It has a
That's
lock
smart.
so that so you can lock it in its collapsed position, because this lens extends quite a bit when you go out to 400.
So
So
simultaneously, I guess what I'm saying is I think it's a really smart addition to their lens lineup, and many people will love it. Many people will want to have it from the get-go if they're getting a new camera. I'm not sure I would want it. I could see myself using it at times, but probably not often enough that I would actually go and buy one.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's not a good choice for
Hey,
others.
if you're buying a camera from scratch and you're considering Nikon mirrorless, maybe a Z5 or something, because you want to take pictures of a lot of things around the house and your kids play sports, I think this is a pretty good choice. And then you got your one lens solution. It's not the cheapest lens because it's over $1,000. But when you consider what it gets you in terms of range, what are you compromising? You're compromising aperture speed. F8 is not exactly going to be fast. But hey, we've talked about that in the past. That's not a big deal most of the time, especially with if you learn how to do some noise reduction. It's not hard. Now, there
And
was
if
an.
you're shooting in nicer weather,
Yeah.
which a lot of people tend to do.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good addition to have some of those that aren't just to targeting the high-end pros, the absolute best of everything, and coming with a, serious price tag to boot, it's a good thing. And then the other night we got an announcement of the Tamron 28 to 75 G2. This is an interesting one
Yeah,
because it's
so it's their
actually been
second,
around. This is its
it's the
second
second
generation.
generation 2.8
Yeah.
lens.
And this has been around in Sony mount for quite a while now. You may also it might also sound a lot from it might sound similar because there's a Nikon 28 to 75 2.8. Right. Well, it turns out
Which
that
is a
is
Tamron.
it, it's a Tamron built lens. It just says Nikon on it. So by all accounts that you had read, this is a it's a new it's a different optical design. It's better, better quality, better
And what
optical
you're
quality.
referring to is what I've read about the Sony version.
Correct, because we're assuming it's the same only with the different mount. So it's interesting to me, just from a corporate philosophy thing. Because I'm pretty sure it's a good lens, and I do like my
It's supposed to
Nikon
be quite
branded
good.
one, and I like my Nikon branded one specifically because it's a nice 2.8 lens. It's not too huge, and it works great for infrared, which is a good thing. That's a different story. The interesting thing then comes into the is Tamron competing with Nikon, even though they so Nikon's F mount or Z mount isn't open. They have an arrangement with Tamron where Tamron is allowed to produce lenses in that mount. And I think that shows up a little in the price tag of this lens. So this lens lists for $999, and the Sony version of it lists for $899, but I see it currently on sale for $799. So there's a $200 markup effectively right now on getting the one in the Z mount. But that being said, the Z mount, the original version, is marked down by a couple hundred dollars. So it's also around $995, $996. So if I were buying one of these and I was willing to wait for the new one to come out, I'd probably be gravitating towards the newer one, right?
I would. Let's eliminate the whole infrared question right now.
Yeah, that's
But
a different story.
if it were just visible light photography, I would absolutely buy the Tamron second generation lens over the Nikon first generation lens. The Nikon one is a lens that Tamron replaced before it even came out. It was an old lens. This one is sharper across the frame.
I think one thing is for sure, there's going to be some I don't think we're going to see the Nikon version, the Nikon branded version, excuse me, return to its MSRP anytime soon. I think that
No.
$999 is going to stick. So you're going to have two choices the same. I you know two options at the same price. But optically, from everything I know, the version two is better. So this is not the case of one being a Nikon design, the other being a Tamron design. Both of them are Tamron designs. It's just one is produced to say Nikon on it, the other is says Tamron on it. So
And it makes me wonder if we will see the same thing happen with the 70 to 180 2.8 lenses. There's a Tamron one made, in Sony mount, et cetera. And then the Nikon branded one made by Tamron. But the current Tamron one is a second generation lens that includes image stabilization, for example, as well as a revised optical design. The Nikon one is, again, the older first generation Tamron that lacks stabilization. So I'm kind of wondering if we'll see the same thing happen with the 70 to 180 lenses in the future.
Well, I'll tell you where that would be
an announcement.
I'll tell you where that would be interesting is that if they do release one that has stabilization built in, it then becomes a reasonable choice for someone shooting DX Nikon like Z50, mm-hmm. because the Z50 doesn't have IBIS.
Right.
So then you would have something like, I forget, you know, but you'd have a pretty good telephoto lens there in mm-hmm. F2.8, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not too big and heavy. So they're nice designs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I mean, I certainly like my Nikon branded one, but mm-hmm. I found it to perform just great. So it's kind of cool. So we've had those.
So it was an interesting announcement in several ways.
Well, it also it signals that this is going to continue, right?
Something's changed.
Something is changing. It's for the better, in my opinion, because you've made this point a lot. If someone's looking to get into a camera system and they don't have the how shall we say baggage of an existing set of lenses,
well, just the prior investment,
right? Yeah, the money. You're going to look at what is the best options in that system at the best prices. And just because somebody offers a $15,000 600 f/4 does not mean that, you know, that's your system. You're gonna gravitate towards ones that get you the lenses that you want for what you like to photograph. So anything that expands on that lineup, in my opinion, is a very good thing. So hopefully Nikon is starting to open up they're being a little more willing to open up their ecosystem bit, shall we say.
I think this is one of those interesting situations where opening things up to competition increases the likelihood that they will sell more bodies and even more lenses, because they've got unique lenses that aren't replicated by third-party manufacturers. Those make sense. The bodies make sense. And if someone likes those third-party lenses and knows that they can buy them, sold. That's a system that makes sense to them.
Well, and when you consider...
And there's some very cool third-party lenses out there. Yeah,
when you consider some stuff for... I wonder if Sigma will start making full-frame Nikon lenses, because right now they only make DX ones.
I'd be willing to bet money they will.
So that would... And that's another good thing, because we both like
those. They've got
some
great ones.
Right.
Really cool.
So I was just thinking, it just popped into my head, you know, there was a time when you bought a film with film, okay? You bought a film camera, and that might be the last one you buy.
Mm-hmm.
So where you bought your lenses made a difference to that company.
Mm-hmm.
Because they might not be selling you another body for 5, 10, or more years, just because there was really no need. With digital cameras, with a, you know, roughly a three-year upgrade cycle, we'll see how that continues. But you could make the case that once they've bought in your system, they will want to buy another body from you. Even if they own a third-party lens, they might want to upgrade their camera
mm-hmm.
to more pixels or more features, or, you know, subject detection, where I can't even speak, right? So it's not a bad thing. Like, what you're saying is a good thing. It's just another way of saying you might sell more bodies because people are more likely to upgrade a digital body than they ever were a film camera.
Yeah. I think Canon needs to figure that out. They're behind Nikon on this. You know,
they're totally closed, right?
Pretty darn close to it. There's some signs that that's opening up, but not much.
Well,
not much, and it's hurting them.
Yeah, and it's such a tight space. It's such a competitive space that.
Yeah, and they make wonderful cameras. Cameras are great.
Mm-hmm.
But and the lenses that they make are very good. But ideally, you'd have more choices.
Let's
smaller
just imagine
ones,
that
slower
situation.
Ones, some unique ones that just don't line up with their current models, all sorts of things.
If you're going into this thinking that the person will never buy another lens from you, okay, I can understand the feeling that you want them to buy your lens. On the other hand, if it's I'm buying this now, but I'm going to be saving up for the one that you make that's really quite good because I really want that second lens to be fast portrait lens or a macro lens or whatever, then it's not the worst thing in the world because they bought your camera. They're in your system now. And
I think the thing I would say, and then I'll shut up, is if your company's strategy is to try to eliminate any source of competition, you're going to fail. It may take a few years, but you're going to fail.
Yeah, it's a good point. Okay.
Because guess what? They're going to compete against you.
Yeah, that's true.
They are. In fact, they'll figure out new ways of doing it, given that weakness that you just exposed.
You can't beat them, join them.
Yeah.
So let's, I got an email the other day from a client, and he wanted to know about any tips or tricks for dealing with ergonomics or just dealing with repetitive stress types of things, repetitive motion types of things. When post-processing photos for extended periods. And, you know, I don't really have a great answer, but it's a good question because you go on a trip or you do a shoot like what we had in Cuba, we come back with who knows how many pictures. It is very easy to get locked in on your computer and find yourself staring at a screen for, you know, potentially multiple hours. And that can lead to all kinds of issues. You know, there's the obvious repetitive mouse stuff, but there's, you know, I get a lot of tension in my neck and shoulders, especially if you're working on, say, a laptop computer. So it's like, what are the things that you can do? You know, a lot of it really depends on what kind of computer you're using. Because if you use a laptop, and a lot of people do, they use a laptop for their primary computer, you're already starting from an ergonomic bad place because the keyboard and the monitor are not anywhere near the right relative heights. And so if you use a laptop as your main computer, you know, the like at home, your best bet would be to consider getting something like an either a docking station or just an external, maybe a Bluetooth keyboard and mouse, and then putting the laptop on some kind of stand or riser so that the screen is at a better height for you. Because this can, I mean, because when I go on a trip and I'm working in these, you know, cramped little hotel rooms where the desk is way too high, you know, so I'm always putting my hands up and I'm scrunching things up. I mean, 2 days of that, and I'm all of a sudden, I'll just be like, whoa, what the heck happened? I feel like I'm a complete mess. If you are using a desktop computer, monitor height and keyboard height are still important. I was running into some issues and I got a keyboard tray that just bolts onto my desk, lowered that keyboard a little bit, makes things a lot more, I'm less likely to hunch up my neck and shoulders. What about you?
I think that's all true. I'm going to go in a different direction on this question, which I think is still relevant because I see something else happening frequently. It's in two parts. First part is, what software is someone using? And is it really appropriate for handling the volume of images or the types of post-processing finishing steps that they're doing? If someone is using manufacturer post-processing software, good Lord, it's terrible in terms of workflow and how long it takes to go through images. You know, first just going through and figuring out what you have and culling and stuff like that. But then the actual processing can take quite a while too, because there aren't nearly as many cool synchronization methods to get edits across a whole bunch of images. You can do it usually, but it's kind of crude. You don't have the cool options for simultaneous editing of a whole bunch of images. So you can really waste a lot of time on your computer doing mundane tasks, not the interesting stuff, and just wear yourself out and then have problems with your back or shoulders or arms, etc., just because of bad software. The second thing, and it's related, is, do you know how to take advantage of the software that you're using? do you have a good workflow for going through images? Like the worst possible thing is to download, let's say, a whole bunch of images from Cuba and then start with each one and go, okay, I'm going to edit this one. I'm going to do a bunch of things and then see what I think. Then I'm going to go to the next image, go through it and see what I think.
Which is tempting. Don't get me wrong. That is tempting because you find a good picture and you want
to
edit it.
You'll waste a lot of time. Far better to go through all of them just in a cursory level and say, yeah, that one could work maybe. No, that one won't. Yeah, that one could. No, that one can't. Something that simple. And then go through in waves of activities. Maybe do basic edits to the ones that you think are maybes and see what happens. I think if you have an organized workflow with good software, the likelihood that you're going to end up in a situation where you're just taking vast amounts of time editing stuff gets diminished quickly.
I'll throw out one other thing too.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked with a lot of people, clients, etc. And there's kind of, they fall into two groups. Many people, and most people, and you or I are the same here, mm-hmm. will download photos each day that they're on mm-hmm. a trip. Even right. if it's just to something like what we were doing in Cuba, which was in my case, an iPad.
Same here.
You know, and going through those photos on the evening by evening basis, or when we were on a bus ride or whatever, and just marking the ones that were worth coming back to later. Okay. And then taking advantage of that software so that when I had them at home, those markings came over to my desktop machine and I could just see those. And then edit a few that I wanted to edit. But other people don't like that. I mean, and that's, there's nothing wrong with this, but some people just say, no, I want to take the pictures and I will look at them when I get home.
Mm-hmm.
Now you come home with 2,000 pictures. That's a lot of time. So if that's what you want to do, I'm not telling you not to do that. It's not how I would prefer it. But this goes with any kind of computer work. Regular breaks. Stop what you're doing. Set a timer and take breaks every hour. Get up, stretch, have a cup of coffee, whatever you want to do. If you're sitting in front of your computer for more than 2 hours straight, you're just setting yourself up for disaster in terms of, you know, ergonomic, repetitive stress, tension, whatever. So
I think you're also likely to end up with edits that aren't as good. Too much saturation, not enough contrast, too much contrast, all those things because of how your brain gets acclimated to looking at images. Breaks are important for that reason too.
So the bottom line is that when the question is, how do you deal with editing for hours at a time? The answer is
try not to.
Right. Yeah. Don't do that. Edit in chunks or edit as you go.
Use good software. Use a good workflow.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've and I appreciate these questions that came into me as an email.
Oh, it's a good one.
And if you have questions for us and suggestions for the show, you know, you can reach us. There's contact information on imagedoctorsphoto.com. You can also message us on Facebook. Just look for Image Doctors on Facebook, and we're there too. That's all the time we have for this week. Looking forward to looking through the submissions we got from our patron sponsors for this month's friendly photo review, which will come up in our bonus video episode, which is open to all of our show sponsors. ImageDoctorsPhoto.com. You can sign up to be a pledge an amount to be a sponsor. So until next time, happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.